This is Persuasion in Business, hosted by me, Dr. Mindy Weinstein. I'm a marketing researcher, the author of The Power of Scarcity, a professor, and a marketer myself. In this podcast, you'll discover practical tools based on psychology you can use to improve your business, sales, and career today. I am really excited for this episode of Persuasion in Business. It's actually probably going to go down as one of my favorites. It is about the power of scarcity. And a hint for you, that's what I wrote my book about. We know that scarcity influences us. Scarce products are often perceived as better, and they cause us to compete with one another. That's the focus of this episode. Not only will we get into what this means to us as consumers, but also what this means to us in business. Do you know why scarcity drives product sales? Well, today I have your answer. On a recent Saturday, I tagged along with my husband to Total Wine. And if you've ever been to Total Wine before, or BevMo, or another huge liquor store, you know it can be a bit overwhelming. He wanted to go to Total Wine because he wanted to purchase a bottle of tequila. When we walked in the store, he went one direction down the tequila aisle. I went down another because for me, I was thinking, you know what? It's hot. We live in Phoenix. Let's make some sangria for tomorrow. Spend the day in the pool. It'll be great. So I headed straight to the white wine section, specifically looking for Sauvignon Blanc. The selection was overwhelming. I mean, bottles lined the shelves from all different regions. If you want wine from Argentina, they had it. Wine from France, they had it. Wine from Italy. Wine from Sonoma. Just so many choices available. And they were in all different price points. My eye, though, was drawn to a handwritten note, or sign, I should say, that was on top of one display of some bottles of Sauvignon Blanc that indicated that that particular wine was the best value. I didn't recognize the brand. I picked it up anyway. I was checking out the bottle, trying to figure out, well, what's so special about this one? Why is this one the best value? Here is where my concern lied. This wine that I was holding, I don't even think it was $6. It was five something, so about $5 for this bottle of wine. Now, I don't have an issue drinking inexpensive wine. My favorite go-to everyday wine is from Trader Joe's, and it's a whopping $6.99. So price isn't necessarily an issue there in terms of it being inexpensive. But when it was a wine that I had never heard of, I was skeptical. I was going to put it in sangria, but come on, you want to have some nice sangria when you're sitting out by the pool. So I started to wonder, how good could this wine actually be if it's just a little over $5? I must have looked a bit perplexed, I should say, as I just stood in the aisle staring, because that's what I was doing, at this bottle of wine in my hand, because a saleswoman approached me. She saw the brand that I was holding, and she instantly told me that this wine was so great, she was shocked that they even had it in stock. Then she went on to tell me about a customer who had called that morning asking if they had that wine in stock. Because I guess this customer had been calling all the different Total Wines in the area, and they were all out of it. And this woman and her husband, it was their favorite wine. So apparently, according to the saleswoman, this customer had come in that morning and purchased three cases. So this saleswoman was just surprised that there was any left at all. Okay, now this wine had my attention a little bit. I found that interesting, but I still wasn't 100% convinced that that was the wine for me. Then another salesperson walked by, and he also told me he was surprised that that wine was in stock. He went on to tell me that the wine was such a great value, and he didn't know how much longer Total Wine would even have it. Okay, now I was sold. I've had two people tell me this. I went looking for my husband, and he had the shopping cart, and I told him, hey, listen, this wine is amazing. We need to buy it. We're going to get a full case of it. He just said, okay, that's pretty much kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, whatever you want to do. So we walked over, stocked up, got a whole case of wine. So not one bottle, 12 bottles. I only needed one for my sangria, but that didn't really matter. Now, on the drive home, I was going on and on about how excited I was that we were able to buy this wine. And I even started talking about my plan to go back the next day and to buy the rest of the bottles they had in stock. I mean, after all, if it keeps selling out, who knows if Total Wine will come back with it and restock it. I didn't want to miss out. That night, after dinner, dishes were done. I took out the wine glasses. I had already chilled the wine. I poured a glass for my husband and I. We sat down on the couch, did a little toast, and then we both took a sip. But then I paused and I asked my husband what he thought. His response, well, it's okay for white wine, but outside of sangria, I don't really like white wine. My comment, yeah, me neither. Okay, I know right now you are thinking that I'm completely crazy, that I bought not just one bottle of wine, but 12 bottles of wine of white when I don't even drink white. I mean, who does that? Well, there were some psychological principles at work here, and I fell for it. I even wrote a book about scarcity. My book is actually called The Power of Scarcity. I spent years studying this subject. I've used these principles in marketing. I've taught them, studied them, done types of research, and I still fall for them. It's because scarcity is that powerful. It is a huge principle of influence. In my situation with the wine, as I mentioned, there were some psychological principles at work. And we're going to get into each of those. And then we're going to think about how this might work in your professional life or in your business. So the first psychological principle, when a product is popular, we assume it must be good. The second one, we have a physiological reaction when something is scarce. And finally, we compete for scarce items. Let's get into each of these a little bit more. Starting with the first one, when a product is popular, we assume it must be good. So think about it. If something's in high demand, we automatically put a greater value on it. I mean, I just told you about that wine. It actually had a sign that said best value. And the fact that it was low in stock certainly told me that this must be good. After all, why would people be buying that product? They wouldn't buy it if it were bad, right? With this mindset, we start to value something to the degree that it's unavailable to us. Scarcity actually becomes a market-based indicator of value, and it increases our desire for the scarce product. For me, knowing the wine was popular indicated that the wine must be pretty good. And really, I'm sure it was pretty good if you like white wine. There's some research that really supports this idea of preferring things that are scarce over things that are not scarce. In 2015, there were two marketing professors that got together and decided to study this very thing. They had their small research team and they recruited, though, over 200 people to participate in their study. So quite a few people were involved. Those who participated were told that the study was about people's gift card choices and that they would be presented with $25 gift cards from five stores, including Amazon, Target, Walgreens, Whole Foods, and Home Depot. The researchers told them to pick four gift cards, and it was explained that after the research was done, three lucky participants would be chosen at random to receive the four gift cards that they had selected. Not a bad deal. Do you want to know what this study was really trying to uncover? It wasn't just people's gift card choices. The study was really trying to uncover whether limited availability made a difference in preference. To put it simply, would people prefer one gift card over another if they thought that gift card was in limited supply? The answer is yes. So these participants, they were divided into groups, and they were told to rank their preferences for the gift cards. And remember, part of what was told to these participants was that they had the chance to win the gift cards that they selected. So keep that in mind. It was explained to one group that only a few gift cards were available from each store. Now to the other group, they were told that, oh, there's plenty. There's many gift cards available. When the gift cards were perceived as being low in supply, participants reacted to the news that the gift cards were scarce. And as we've seen in countless examples so far, this reaction was to want the gift cards even more. How are businesses using this principle? Well, have you ever gotten an email letting you know that a product is running low in stock or an event is filling up? While these emails are great, they keep you informed, they also indicate that that particular product or that event, whatever it is, must be pretty good. Salespeople can also use this principle, and many of them do. Let me tell you a story about my friend Paul. I live in Arizona, as some of you know, and part of the year it is a bit hot. When it's 115, we stay inside or we go in the pool. But for the rest of the year, it's pretty nice, which means that we are a great market for hot tubs. My friend Paul was in the market for a hot tub. He had just redid his entire backyard. He had the perfect place for it. He decided that it was time that he was going to invest in one so he could enjoy the desert nights, all of that, sitting under the stars. Now, he explained to me that he had narrowed down the features that he wanted in the hot tub, such as the size, the filtration system, even the seat configuration. I didn't know a whole lot about hot tubs until he started explaining it to me, but I guess you can have lounge chairs within hot tubs. I guess that's the way you explained it, where you get to lounge in the hot tub. You can have seats where you sit upright. You can have even some of them that are configured. You could stand there. Go figure. But I learned a lot talking to my friend Paul. But let's get back to his story. So he had done all his research. He knew exactly what he wanted. And of course, he also had a budget in mind. He could spend $10,000 for this new hot tub. After going to a few different stores one weekend, he ended up at a new store that carried a line of spas that he had never heard of before. He walked in, he was perusing the hot tubs, making his way through the showroom, you know, looking at all the different hot tubs that were available, and he found one. It was perfect. It met all the criteria he'd been looking for. It checked all the boxes, sat 7 people, the right size, had the right seating configuration. It even had the filtration system that he wanted. Well, a salesperson walked over to Paul and they began to discuss the hot tub that he was interested in. And Paul was really happy when he found out that that hot tub was just under his budget. So the final price would be $9,500. Remember, his budget was $10,000. Well, during this conversation though, the salesperson walked Paul over to another tub that was bigger, and of course, more expensive. It was $14,000, but it had an option to add an automated water care system. Apparently, as Paul told me later, the add-on would let Paul monitor and control the pH level of the spa, which I guess is very important, and also ensure that the water was at the right, you know, sanitation or sanitizer level. Up until this point, though, Paul had never even heard of this type of water care system. He didn't know it existed. So he got interested in it. It sounded great. So he asked the salesperson, well, can I get that same add-on on the other hot tub? That's $9,500. That's more in my price range. Well, the answer was no. Paul was now in a situation where he really wanted that automated water care system, even though he had no idea it existed before walking into the store. The fact that it wasn't available for the hot tub model he was looking at only made that system even more desirable to him. But think about it. To get the system, he would have to buy a hot tub that was $4,500 over his budget. Unavailability, also known as scarcity, increased the value of that automated water care system in Paul's mind. He felt like he had to have it, even though he really still didn't know much about it. He hadn't done his research. He hadn't read reviews. He had only just found out about it. Now, Paul decided to take the night to think about it. And when he woke up the next morning, he decided, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to go over my budget by 50% to make sure that I have this system because he wanted to have it. That's what scarcity does to us. And that really leads right into another principle that was at work in my wine example. We actually have a physiological reaction when something is scarce. One of the things that was discovered in that 2015 study that I mentioned with the gift cards was that participants had a higher level of physiological arousal when learning about a gift card with low supply. I know that sounds really odd, but that's the clinical term for it. It basically means that they had a physical reaction. They heard that the supply of those particular gift cards were low, and they physically responded in some way. That's what that means. And it's odd, but it's actually part of something, a concept, I should say, known as reactance theory. This theory is not new. It's been around a long time. It dates back to 1966. It's based on the idea of motivation. According to reactance theory, when we are faced with a perceived threat or loss of a behavioral freedom, we'll have a physiological reaction and we'll be motivated to restore that freedom. This means that we might feel our hearts start to beat a bit faster, our hands become a little sweaty, we start to have those physical signs of stress. We even sometimes get into a state of anxiety, resistance, and even distress. Under the reactance theory, there are some assumptions. It is assumed that we have a set of free behaviors that we think we can act on. Now, these free behaviors are things that we have done before, or we're currently doing, or we might do in the future. It's also assumed that when our free behaviors are threatened or taken away, we become motivated to restore our freedom. This reactance happens involuntarily, and it doesn't require a lot of mental energy. We're not thinking it through. It automatically happens. It can be so strong that it causes us to make decisions that have negative consequences, like Paul spending money he shouldn't have spent on something that he didn't really need or know that he wanted, but he didn't want that option to be taken away from him. So it all seems pretty deep. We're talking about freedoms and threat of freedom, but we're just talking about behaviors, the way that we react to situations. And it might seem like an extreme response to when a product is running low in stock, but think about the last time you were told no, or that you couldn't have something. Most likely, you had some type of reaction, whether that was agitation or even just a faster heartbeat. When I was faced with the wine that was running low in stock, I subconsciously felt my freedom to choose that wine was being threatened. I know that sounds silly. I mean, we're talking about inexpensive wine here, but this is how we are made. This is how our brains operate. My response was to buy that wine. And remember, I bought it in bulk. I bought a case because I wanted to buy it while I still had the freedom to purchase it. And I also wanted to buy it before anyone else could get the remaining bottles. This reaction, remember, was caused by a salesperson informing me of the high demand and the risk of a sellout. In other words, the information was clearly communicated to me. Think about that. Any type of situation where you are selling something or working with a potential customer, everything needs to be honest. But if something truly is in high demand or a risk of being gone, why not communicate it? It's going to cause that reaction. I reacted. I also felt a sense of competition, which is our third and final principle. We will compete for scarce items. One of the most powerful effects of scarcity is the sense of competition. when there's only so much to go around, we find ourselves in a position where we feel like we're competing with others. Maybe we're not, but we feel like we are. Just think about Black Friday. I have gone plenty of times over the years, gotten up early in the morning while it's still dark, got in line, fought the crowds, waited to check out for hours upon end. And it was really, when we stop and think about it, it was excitement, of course, for the deal. But there's also that sense of competition. You might have found yourself in the frenzy of Black Friday shopping with all the other holiday shoppers waiting in line for hours, securing those big deals of the day. The thing about Black Friday is supplies are generally limited and they do sell out. So you technically are competing with others. Even if you didn't and haven't gotten caught up in the frenzy, you at the very least probably have heard the news reports of fights erupting in stores and violence over the deal on the television. This instinct to compete for scarce items is primal. That's actually what got me interested in studying scarcity to begin with. I was already very interested from a marketing perspective, as a marketer, as a researcher, as a teacher, in influence and how that drives our behaviors. But when I started looking more into the influence factors, I found that of all of them, scarcity is the most powerful because, as I just mentioned, it's primal. Our ancestors constantly experienced periods of famine and abundance and had to cope with resource scarcity. Throughout human history, we have competed for survival, meaning we fought to obtain the resources essential for our continued well-being. If you study history and you look at the different empires, they were able to stay in power because they controlled, again, resources. They could control what people got and what they didn't get. Evolutionary biology and economics tells us that this competition for survival is always revolved around scarce resources. And the effect scarcity has now is caused by a combination of deep-rooted instincts and modern challenges. Something you should know though, you hear this, you might think to yourself, that's interesting. Maybe you haven't even thought this yet, but I'll put this thought in your head. Is this something that we learn over time? It might be primal, but does it start to really manifest as we become adults? No. This competition or sense of it starts young. In 2018, there was a research study done that involved 6-year-olds. And what they found was that the young participants that were part of their study preferred items that they viewed as scarce. But their desire for those items only went up when they thought they were competing with other children. So here was the scenario. There's 32 6-year-olds, and you got to just picture this with me. Each child was brought in one at a time, and they were presented with 2 piles of wrapped presents, pretty much. One pile had a lot. They were all identically wrapped, pretty high pile. The other pile just had one single item wrapped. So each child was instructed to pick one. You could pick one from one pile. Well, as you can imagine, most of them still did pick the one that there was just one left. I mean, it's scarce. Why wouldn't you choose that one? However, when that child was told that they got to pick first before other competitors, which were really just the other children as part of the study, they nearly always chose the single item because they felt like they were in competition. They wanted to make sure that they got that wrapped item before anyone else could. And this happened with 6-year-olds. So when those children felt that the scarce item was at risk of being taken by other children, there was that greater urgency to select that item. Going back to the wine example, learning that other customers were calling and buying the wine in large quantities made me take action right away. I didn't feel that I had time to, go home and research my options and, was this really a good wine? What were people saying about it? I felt like I was in competition. someone had already gone to the store that morning and bought cases. How would I know someone was going to come right after me and buy cases? I better buy right now. I had to take action immediately. And if you remember, I even made a comment to my husband on the drive home from Total Wine that I wanted to go back and purchase the rest that they had in stock. I wanted to do that because I wanted to make sure I had my hands on this scarce product before others could buy it. Okay, and I know that might sound selfish, but that's part of what we're talking about here. It's that primal instinct of competition. Etsy is really great at applying this principle. So Etsy.com, if you've ever been on that site, it's an e-commerce site, but it features all types of great craftsmanship and customized products that people make and sell. So by the very nature, supplies tend to be limited. So what Etsy has figured out is that if they inform you as the shopper of how many people are viewing that particular item or how many already have it in their cart, plus how many are left if the quantity is low, that's going to catch your attention. Could be something to consider if you're in e-commerce. Even if you're not in the business of selling wine, there are a lot of practical ways to implement these concepts. If a service or a product you offer is one that's popular among your customers, make that clear. It could be a simple restocked label on your website, or restocked is part of your subject line in your email. It could be a sign that you attach to the product itself. But let's move on from products. You might be in a service-oriented business. It could even be a proposal that explains the option that most clients choose, which indicates popularity. It could even be something that comes up in conversation when you're talking to a potential client. If they're not sure which service option to choose, you could very simply tell them, well, most of my clients choose to go with this option or this type of retainer or this type of engagement. Easy way to implement the mentality of showing what is popular. The same idea applies going back to products if something's low in stock. Make that clear to your customers. If you're a service area business with limited time available, that's also something to communicate. For example, if you're a consultant and you're talking to a prospect on the phone, it's okay to tell them that you only work with a certain amount of clients at any given time. Your time is naturally going to be limited, and there is no problem communicating that with someone. In fact, communicating something like that can actually just increase your value. And in these scenarios that I'm throwing out at you, all of them let potential customers and clients know that there is some form of scarcity, which can lead to action. If you remember my initial question, now we know why scarcity drives product sales. There are a lot of psychological principles at play. Join us for the next episode as we dive into more on the psychology of persuasion. We have covered a lot today. I mean, I haven't told you my story about the white wine that I don't even drink. But as crazy as that story might have sounded and made you wonder how I could teach this topic yet fall for it, I really just think that shows how powerful scarcity really is. That even if we know it's happening and we understand it, we are still susceptible to it. And I'm sure you have stories too. I would love to continue the conversation in the Persuasion in Business Forum. Simply visit persuasionnextsteps.com and tell us your story. It could be a story where you were faced with a sales situation and scarcity was present, or you might be a salesperson and you want to share your great techniques with us. Whatever it might be, again, I would love to hear from you. Be sure to also subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and follow me on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram.